Hi, everybody. My name is Casey. I'm an alcoholic. I wish you could have been in my mind for the last 5 or 10 minutes. I have given an incredible talk, and I really hate that you missed that one. Lots of stuff went through my mind as they were reading the purpose, especially the part about primary purpose is to stay sober. You know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And for a long, long time, I didn't know if I could qualify for this program. I didn't think I was a bad enough drunk to be here. So it was good to hear that. I want to start by thanking the committee, because if I don't do this now, I'll forget, for having me and Burns here this weekend, and for that kind of faith. And I especially want to thank Mickey and Jim. They're very special people in our lives, and I told Jim this earlier, and I sincerely mean it. They're the reason why I accepted this, because I do not like to speak. But I really love you all, and this is for you. And if I screw it up, don't hold it against me. This is also what happens when you let your ego get in the way. They called and I thought, speak at a conference, I can do that. Wish I hadn't thought that one either, actually. I did bring notes, so if I keep looking down, I thought about trying to hide them, but who cares, you know. I have notes. This is just really a security blanket. But there were a few things that I didn't want to not get to, and thanking the committee was a big one. I spent some time thinking about what I wanted to say when I got here, and we travel a lot. We go to a lot of conferences, and people get up, and they're just such wonderful speakers, and they always have a joke. So I was thinking, what joke do I want to tell? And sanity prevailed, and I remembered I can't tell jokes. I can't tell jokes in a crowd of people that I know. I can't tell a joke to one person in a room. So why would I think that I could tell a joke in front of 100 people, of whom most of them I didn't know, and pull it off without screwing up the punchline so there will be no jokes? Burns will do the jokes tomorrow night. He's wonderful at telling jokes. So we can just get that out of the way. It may be funny and it may be tragic. I don't know. I also told Walt before I started. Walt heard me speak. Walt and Neva both heard me speak down in, where was I? Joe Wheeler. The first time, and I thought the last time I'd ever do this. And he said he was looking forward to hearing me again, and hopefully he's being rigorously honest. I don't know. But you're not going to hear the same talk. Forget it, Walt. Okay. I will start out by saying that I did have a childhood. There was a time when I spent an awful lot of time telling you about my childhood and how bad it was, and I'm not going to do that tonight. What I want to focus on about growing up for me as a child was the way that I felt inside. Regardless of what was going on outside of me, I was always afraid. I was always insecure. And I never felt like I really quite fit in, with the exception of in school. I was what you would call a teacher's pet, and it wasn't because I was really kissing up. It's just that I really liked school, and I did very well in it. It made me feel good about myself, and so I did a lot of reading, and a lot of school was really easy for me, and so I did really well. And I made good grades, and I would be so proud of that. I'd come home, and I'd have 100 on this and 100, and I made straight A's through most of all of my grade school and up into high school. But the strangest thing in looking back on that was that even with all of those A's and all those hundreds, I always had that nagging feeling that the next time I wasn't going to be able to do it. The next time I wasn't going to be able to make that 100% or that A or whatever, or the next time, or somebody was going to find out that, I don't know, I guess I was going to school with a bunch of morons and I really wasn't all that smart or whatever. It never quite felt good, like it was really mine. I felt good about it, but just for a brief moment, and then it was gone. That feeling of elation was gone. It was like a hit for me. And I guess it was also because I didn't really have to work that hard at it. So in lots of ways, I didn't feel like I deserved it. But anyway, that was, I had a lot of fear and a lot of insecurity, which was real strange since I was doing so well. It seemed like a contradiction. I felt very alone and isolated within myself. And very early on, I learned how to people please in order to get approval and feel secure and feel like I fit in. That just continued on into my adolescence and lots of isolation and insecurity, and I felt very cut off from the other kids that were my age, and this just kept on and nagging at me, and it was a feeling of, am I ever really going to fit in? And yet it wasn't even a conscious thought. My father at that time, my father's a manic depressive, and we did not know that at the time, and about the time I hit puberty, his manic depression really started to spiral downward, and we didn't know what it was, and my mother tried to hide it. She tried to take care of it. It was very much like growing up in an alcoholic home, except with us, it was his manic depression, and Mom tried to make it look okay outside of the house and inside of the house. And this just added my insecurity and my confusion and my shame around that. And my anger was building and getting stronger and stronger. And I really didn't know what to do with it. And I found myself, we'd be riding along in a car. I remember we had a 1962 Impala. And it was a four-door. And we'd be driving down the road, driving up to Johnson City or somewhere to go to a movie or whatever, and we'd be doing about 60 miles an hour. And I'd be sitting there, and I'd look out that window, and I'd think, if I just open this door and jump, it'll all be over with. And I didn't know what that meant. And I'd shake it off, and I'd think, oh, that's a weird thought, you know. But I didn't know what it was about until I got to this program years later. And it was that deep, deep insecurity and anger and confusion and all of those feelings that were just churning inside of me, and I didn't know what to do with them. At about the age of 16, I got my driver's license, and I took my first drink. And the thoughts of killing myself immediately evaporated. I knew I had found the plug, so to speak, that was going to fill up that hole, or that was going to make me feel like I really did fit in with the rest of the people that I was around. I was real afraid of alcohol initially, but it didn't keep me from drinking it. And I would drink on weekends during high school, and then nobody drank in my family, so I couldn't get it during the week. But I did drink every weekend from my junior year on. And I would say, I've said this before, alcohol initially saved my life. Because those feelings were becoming so turbulent. And in those days also, I had asked to see a psychologist, and my parents had brought this person into our home and basically told him that they thought I was going through a phase, but just kind of humor me. And so they did that, and the guy left, and he said, well, she'll be okay. And I was basically getting suicidal, and they just kind of blew that off. And so when I started drinking, it really saved my life. It made me feel whole. It made me feel good about who I was, and it didn't matter where I was from. It saved my life, and it was a good friend of mine for a short period of time, actually, but I thought it was a much longer period of time. But it did at least take away all that anger, or at least I thought it took it away, and what it did is it just drowned it, and I didn't have to look at it anymore. I graduated from high school, and I went on to college, and I need to tell you that I had three requisites for the college that I attended. I'm from Tennessee originally. I was born in Knoxville, Tennessee. Go Vols. Sorry. For all you Alabama people. But the requisites were the drinking age had to be 18 in that state. It had to be at least a 4-hour drive from my home, because I didn't want my parents dropping in, because I already knew what I was going to be doing when I got there. And the ratio of men to women had to be at least 50-50. I was not running any risk. So I found one like that, and it was hard as hell to find one like that. I'm telling you, I didn't care what they specialized in. It just had to cut through those three things, and then I'd major in anything they wanted me to major in. I majored in drama. for about a year and a half. That didn't work out very well either because I don't like to speak in front of people. It was a minor detail that I overlooked in filling out the application. That first day that I got to college, all these little wimpy little girls were all running around crying on their mommy and daddy's neck about, oh, they're going home without me. Take me with you. And I'm going, it's getting a little late. Don't you think y'all get in the car and go now? Just my parents, mom's crying and everything. And they get in the car, and as they top the hill, I walk back into the dormitory and I said, where is the nearest bar? So they sent me down the street to a place called Black Welders in Salisbury, North Carolina. I went down there and ordered up a malt liquor and a barbecue sandwich, and I thought I had died and gone to heaven and bought a pack of Camel cigarettes. Yuck, boy, you talk about sick. I had arrived. It was wonderful. I thought I was so grown up. So if it had not been for, I'm going to tell my age on this, if it had not been for the curfews that the women had on that campus, I'm really grateful that we had the curfews, because if I had not had a curfew to get me in, I would never have made it through that first year. And I know that now in hindsight. I mean, there's nothing left to do but study, so I did. And managed to get through that year. The following summer, I went to Gatlinburg to work. And I had my first real taste of freedom, because then I didn't have anybody telling me when to come and when to go and what to do and what not to do. And people were giving me money. I was a waitress. I was a waitress. Make that real clear. And I met the first of my long line of men who could get me alcohol. And I had done that in high school. I dated college guys when I was in high school because they could get the booze. And so when I was in Gatlinburg, I dated a guy who was the manager at one of the motels, and it happened to have one of those key clubs where if you stayed in the motel, they gave you a key and you could go into the bar and drink. So I sought him out and found him, and we were an item for the entire summer. And so I had all my booze that way in Gatlinburg. Gatlinburg's dry, or was then. It was very dry, except for the taxi cab stand. You could get it there. So that was that summer, and I had really tasted freedom. So when I went back as a sophomore year, we didn't have curfews. Only freshman women had them. And, well, we had them, but not, they weren't as strict. Freshman, it was like 8:30 at night. And sophomore, it was 11. And I had it planned. I mean, I knew exactly which bus I had to catch to get back to the campus before the door was locked. And I probably made a total of maybe 6 classes that semester. And that is not a funny, and it's not a joke. That's the serious God's truth. I was drunk every night. I had been drunk every night in Gatlinburg, so I didn't see any point in changing the pattern, because that's what I wanted to do, was drink. It was much more fun than going back and studying, rolling each other's hair and stuff like that. I mean, so I would go downtown and drink and catch the last bus back, and then in the morning when everybody else was going to class, I was sleeping in. And I had an advisor who called me in, and he said, what seems to be the problem? And I said, well, I just don't feel like going to class. And he never asked me about, are you drinking or anything like that? You know, he just said, well, you know, I know it's hard to settle down and try to get back into your classes. And I said, well, okay, and didn't mean to do it at all. And I didn't. Still didn't go back to class. About halfway through that semester, I started waking up in the middle of the night screaming. I was having dreams of rats crawling all over my body and eating, chewing on my face and all kinds. And I'd wake up in a cold sweat screaming. So they decided I needed to see the college psychologist. And I got an appointment, went over, talked to him. Nice guy, sat and cried 2 or 3 sessions, you know. And he finally came to the, he never asked me about my drinking. Never asked me if I drank. Nothing, you know. He decided I was not mature enough for college and that I probably needed to go home and work a little bit longer and try to figure out what I wanted to do with my life, and then I could come back to school. So I went on. You know, I left college, and I went back home for a brief period of time, and then I went back to Gatlinburg. And I spent about another 18 or 20 months in Gatlinburg, and it is mostly a blur. I did a lot of drinking, a lot of drugs, a lot of pot, a lot of jobs, lived in a lot of places, saw the sunrise a lot in a real comatose condition, so to speak, and it was just a blur, and needless to say, it was not a good scene. So I decided to leave there, another geographical cure, and I moved to Louisville on the advice of a drummer in a band and his wife. I moved with them back to Louisville. And that's really where, in a sense, my bottom began and my recovery definitely started in Louisville. And I did move to Louisville on November the 1st, 1971. I've now been there, what does that make it, 22 years. It's the longest time I've ever lived in any one place in my life. And like Walt and I were talking about last night, it's my hometown now. I am from Knoxville, Tennessee, but Louisville's my home. And I really do love it there. And I went in and out of jobs there. I was always a bar drinker. So I got jobs in bars. And people would buy you drinks and, you drink after hours and one thing and another. And I just went through all of that stuff. I finally got tired of asking for my drinks, so I decided the best way to get to it is to become the bartender, because they were in charge. And I do like control, so I decided I can do that. And so I lied and went and applied for a job and said, yes, I'm a bartender. And they asked me for references, and I said I'd really rather not put them down because I didn't have any. See, so I just kept at this guy, and he finally did hire me, and he knew I didn't know how to tend bar. But it was a daytime job, and he figured, how bad can it be? So I began tending bar, and I was always really responsible drunk. That was the interesting thing. I would not call in sick to work. I was always there, no matter how hungover. I just always showed up, and that was one of the things that tripped me up about being an alcoholic and coming into this program, because I thought, you had to be a real irresponsible kind of person who never showed up for work and quit all the time. I quit all the time, but I always showed up for work when I was working there. And so I started attending bar, and I really liked it. And I was attending bar during the day and drinking at night. And I would get in about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning and have to be up and back to work by 10 o'clock in the morning. And, it really got rugged, because when you're out to 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, drinking and then getting up and going into a bar that's stale beer and stale cigarettes, it's really hard on you. And I used to say that I never drank on the job, and that was not true because I did a lot of drinking on the job. I would go in and open up, and you got to clear the tap on a keg of beer because it's built up pressure overnight, and it'd spit out this foam, and you'd catch it in a cup. And I just set it up there, and I just keep an eye on it. And when it settled down enough to where there was something to drink, I'd drink it. But I didn't count it as drinking because it was just off the tap. It didn't count as a real beer. It's kind of like Oreo cookies don't really have calories if they're in crumbs. So I did a lot of that. And towards the end of that particular daytime job, I was doing a lot of, I started drinking screwdrivers. I started drinking vodka in the morning in orange juice because I was just hurting. I was not feeling real good at all, and I was having visions of clearing the back bar, just starting to throw things. That anger that I had as an adolescent and as a child was starting to come back up again, and the alcohol was not stopping it anymore. It was there, back, and living alive and well in me. At about that time, I started getting real sick, and I went in at the request of my roommate at that time, and I went to see several doctors. I went to 3 doctors, and all 3 of them said the same thing. None of them asked. Well, they asked me if I drank, and I said, "Yeah, I have 2 drinks a day," and they bought that. And then they all said that I was just highly nervous, and they all wrote me prescriptions for Valium, which I did not fill, because I did not want to take Valium, because I knew that if you took Valium and drank, you'd end up like Karen Ann Quinlan in a coma, and I was too afraid of that. And so I just didn't take it, and I kept drinking, and I kept drinking, and I kept drinking. Finally, some people that I work with said, why don't you go out and see our doctor? He's just really good. And I said, I'm tired of going to doctors. They just keep giving me these prescriptions, these fool pills. I'm not going to do it. And they said, no, he's really different. He's really different. He's really different. So I said, okay. And made an appointment, and I went out. And he did a real thorough exam and asked a lot of really interesting questions that nobody had ever asked, like history of diabetes and that sort of thing. And what we came to find out was I was diabetic. And my blood sugar was not in real good shape at that point. So he put me on, not on insulin, but just on diet control. And he said to me, now you know, as a diabetic, you really should not be drinking. And I follow instructions. I mean, I read cereal boxes. I don't ever try to put anything together without reading the directions. And when I'm told a direction, generally I'll do it, you know. And so I thought, oh, okay, I can't drink anymore. This is life-threatening. I won't drink. So for about the next 2.5 months, I didn't drink. Drank a lot of coffee, and I smoked a lot of cigarettes, and I hated a lot of people, but I didn't drink. Hated a lot of people. Had a lot of resentments about paying a dollar for a cup of coffee in a bar. So anyway, it was a Derby of 1976, and I'm out at this Holiday Inn that I worked for at that time, or the people I worked for, and I'm out at the bar having the breakfast buffet for all those who worked for this particular man. He invited all of his employees out to have breakfast on Derby Eve, and I go out there, and there's my doctor sitting in the bar, face down on the table. No, close to face down on the table, actually, just in real bad shape. And so cute me, I'm sober, you know, and I go, oh, let's go say hello to Dr. Brady, you know? And my friends who sent me to him initially said, no, don't bother him. Don't bother. He's relaxing. Leave him alone, you know? I said, no, I'm going to go over there. So I did. I said hello to him, and he looked up and he said, you want to dance? And I said, well, I don't think so, because I knew he was married, and I had a run-in with a married man, and which is not one of my greater achievements, but nonetheless I had, and I had said I would never do it again. And so I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And he said, well, why not? And I said, well, I you know, you're married, and I just don't do that. And he said, oh, no, we're getting a divorce. And I grabbed him by the hand, said, let's hit the floor. Let's do it. And I need to back up and say that the first time, and I've not really said this before, but the first time that I went in to see him, and my friends, you know how it's kind of hairdressers and doctors and all that, if you're referred by a friend, they always want to know, what'd you think? You know, did you like him? And I told him, I said, you know, I really liked him. And they started, and they knew about this affair that I'd had, and they said, leave him alone, he's married. And I said, I know, I'm not going to do that, but I really did like him. And I was thinking about this, and the thing that attracted me to him the most at that particular time, that first couple of times I saw him in his office, was I felt safe in his presence. I knew that this was a good man, and I've always known that. I don't always say that. But he felt safe to me, and so when he offered to dance with me, it was, let's do it, because this is the best thing that I've seen in my life in a long, long time, and I really did not want to run the risk of missing it. So we were dancing, and I won't even go into the rest of that story, but needless to say, we started dating at that point, and about a month later, he asked me to go to Florida with him, and I really did turn him down several times, and finally I said, okay, I'll go, and we went down, and we're sitting at dinner, and that first night, and he said, what do you want to drink? And I said, I don't drink. And he says, what do you mean you don't drink? And I looked at him, and I was confused, and I said, I don't drink. You told me I couldn't drink. And he said, why did I tell you that? I was starting to get a little nervous about that. You know, I thought, this is my doctor, and he can't remember why he told me not to drink. And I said, you know, the diabetes thing. Remember, I'm not supposed to. Oh, that. Well, you're just not supposed to drink too much. Was I excited or what? Oh, God. I can remember that moment. I could feel the warmth just starting to rise. It was like, yes. So I started drinking again, and just like that. I mean, it was back. And, of course, he was delighted with it because he had a drinking buddy. And I was delighted with his decision that I really wasn't all that sick. Lots of things happened during that time period. We lived together for the next 18 months or something like that while his divorce was being finalized. We just never separated. We just stayed together. It was just like we did this and stayed. And I remember one night, though, I used to try to watch his drinking because I knew one of us had to stay sober enough to drive home. And one night, neither one of us were really, well, one night, many nights, neither one of us were sober enough to drive home. This one particular night, we were over at this lady's house, and she had her eye on him, okay? And she kept saying, why don't you all just spend the night? And I thought, like hell we're going to spend the night. I'm taking him home. I didn't know where she was going to end up with him, but I was not going to give her that opportunity. I was so ticked. And so I said, we're going home. And I got the keys. It was that gray Riviera. And he's in the passenger side, and I'm in the driver's side, and I'm trying to back out of her driveway, and I should not even be trying to back out of the toilet at that point. And I back up, and I swing out onto the road, and I hear this. And I think, oh, no. And I turn, and I look out my window, and it says U.S. Mail. I just sideswiped a whole line of mailboxes on the other side of the street. So I go home, and I think, well, maybe he won't notice. So he gets up. This is a Saturday night. He gets up the next morning. He has to go do rounds in the hospital. He's on call that night. That's a joke. And he goes out to the hospital, and I'm off that day because we're closed on Sunday. And he comes home, and he says, some son of a bitch hit my car last night. It's all wrecked, torn up, and da-da-da-da-da. And I said, that was me. And so I confessed at that point. And he was just real sweet about it. He really was. He was real good about it. I thought he was going to kill me. Turned out he really never liked that car anyway, I don't think. But anyway, so Burns, we continued drinking together, and I really did try to watch my drinking because I did feel like one of us needed to try to be sober enough to get home. But toward the end, I couldn't tell when I was going to get drunk and when I wasn't. I'd go in and have two drinks and be just knee-walking, and other times I'd go out and I'd have 10 drinks and nothing. And generally, it was when I wanted to get drunk, I couldn't. And when I wanted to try to stay sober, I couldn't. It was just strange. And it was confusing me. And about that time, I won't tell his story, but anyway, he did go to treatment. And I quit drinking when he quit drinking. And he was gone for a while and came back, and he got into AA. And I went to Al-Anon, for the first 5 years that he was in AA, and I didn't drink. I have not had a drink since sometime around the end of December of 1977. But what I did do is I took some prescription medication, what I consider to be inappropriately. I would have these kind of pseudo-migraine headaches, tension-related, and I would call him up at the office and say, you know, I've got this really bad headache, and I can't shake it. It won't go away. I don't understand. He'd say, well, did you take any aspirin? And I'd say, yes, when actually I hadn't. And he said, well, go take your Tylenol with codeine. And so I did that sporadically for those 5 years that I was in Al-Anon. The other two things that I did that I in order to just calm me down is when we got married, and I don't know if you know this or not, but when we got married, the day we got married, I took a tranquilizer before the service because I was so scared of being in front of people. And since I was the bride, I figured most people would be looking at me. Worked out that way. So I was blissed coming down the aisle. It was fun, no problem. And then when my grandfather died in 1980, I really didn't think I was going to get through that. And I took some tranquilizers, some Transine for that. So I don't really claim to be in sobriety quite as long as Burns has been. I went to Al-Anon for 5 years, and I really had a hard time with Al-Anon because I didn't have the war stories that so many of you gals and guys have, because I'd always drank with Burns, and I'd never been married before, and my parents didn't drink, so I didn't come out of an alcoholic family. I didn't have an alcoholic spouse to, you know, nothing. But I went, and I figured it was the auxiliary, and I had to do that to be supportive. But I couldn't quite get it, and I didn't know how the steps applied to me. I couldn't get them to work. I never did a fourth and fifth step in Al-Anon. I did get a sponsor, and she was a little bitty wiry woman, Betty F. I figured she was just mean enough. I liked her spirit, so I grabbed her. But I didn't do much in that program, except I listened a whole lot, and I learned a lot about detachment with love and trying to keep the focus on me and how important is it, all those wonderful things that I hear a lot of Al-Anons talk about. And I really appreciated all those ladies that I met in Al-Anon, and they were really gifts to me, and I just was still too sick to know it at the time. About 5 years into recovery, I met a friend of mine named Darcy R. from, now she's down in Florida, invited me to come down to a conference called Women in Recovery. And it's a 12-step, it's for women in any form of 12-step program. And it was held down at St. Simon's Island in the spring of the year. And I said, I think I'd like to do that. And I had never really gone anywhere without Burns before. And something just was drawing me. I mean, it was just so bizarre that I would even want to do that. But I said, yeah, I think I'd like to do that. I'll come down. And from the very first speaker that night, and that was Lou V, and she's over in South Carolina now, that it started. I started to understand why I didn't understand all those years in Al-Anon. I started to realize that my problem was not living with an alcoholic, or it was living with an alcoholic, but I was the alcoholic that I was trying to live with without the benefit of this program directly for me. And so it was May the 28th of 1983 that I picked up my white ship down at St. Simon's Island. And that is my sobriety date in my heart. And it was on St. Simon's Island at that time that I took that first, second, and third step. And I continued to take the first, second, and third step every day on an ongoing basis. And those are the three steps I never miss. I may not do all the other steps on any given day, but I always take those first three steps. I have no doubt in my mind that I am powerless over alcohol and a number of other substances that I won't go into. But I remember how I did all of those things, and I never did it in any stretch of the imagination of moderation, never, from day one. Didn't think I needed to at the time, and at the end couldn't do anything but. And so I'm real dedicated to those three steps. I don't always turn my life over to the will of God, but I take the step. You know, I made a decision. I make the decision every day. I don't turn it over every day. I just decide that that's what I'd really like to try to do that day. And some days I do and some days I don't. So I came into AA and I got a sponsor and I got a lady who had 24 years of sobriety. What I was looking for was age in more than one way. I wanted somebody who'd been around a long time, and I wanted somebody to be my mother is what I really wanted, as it turned out. And this lady was more than willing and ready to do both of those things for me. And we had a really good year, a little over a year together. And then she drank again. And interestingly enough, I took my fourth and fifth step with her in the spring, or late winter. And she drank or we found out she had been drinking that spring. When I took that first, fourth, and fifth step with her, looking back on it now, it was just really my life history. It really wasn't what the big book says is a fourth and fifth step. I did an autobiography with her. And it ended at that fifth step because then, you know, she went out and got drunk and I dropped the ball. I just didn't take the responsibility of doing the rest of the steps on my own. I looked around for some sponsors in a panic and picked out a couple of people that I'm sure are really lovely people, but we just didn't work together. So for about 5 years, I went without a sponsor. In the midst of all that 5 or 6 years, I went into some counseling. I went in to do some ACOA issues, and I know that can be a red flag for a lot of people, but it really did help me a whole lot. What I used to tell myself was that I was doing my fourth and fifth step in group. And I did. I mean, I got in touch with a lot of resentments and a lot of pain and a lot of background history and a lot of things I'd forgotten. But there was no sixth and seventh step in there. There was behavior modification in there, but there was no looking at my character defects in that. And so I stayed for a while in group. I stayed real stuck and still blaming all these people. See what they did to me. See what they did to me. These are my resentments, and this is why. And by God, I've got a reason to be resentful because see what they did to me. And it took me a really long time. I'm grateful for the therapy, and I am a counselor. I believe in therapy, but either because I didn't have a sponsor to kick my butt or because I wasn't motivated or whatever, that's all I did was fourth and fifth step in there. Dug up a lot of resentments. It helped me on my next fourth step, certainly. Also in that time period, I went back to school because I had always wanted to have a college degree, and one of the things that I felt the worst about myself was the fact that I had not finished college, that I had literally, I guess I kind of skipped over that part in a sense. I flunked out of college that sophomore year because I drank myself out of college. I didn't even do the finals. I just dropped out, incompletes across the board. So I went back to school in 1987 and 1991. I graduated from the University of Louisville and got my undergraduate degree, and hope to go back and get a master's sometime in the near future. But that was something that I did for myself after having come into this program of putting my life back together again and fulfilling some of those dreams that I had lost along the way because of my drinking and because of my illness, not only the active drinking, but the years that I wasn't drinking and was just simply sick. So I got through that, and what I would like to talk about now basically is what's been important to me in the program, in those years interwoven in there, from 1983 on, with all the therapy and all the school and all the different sponsors and the ins and outs. And one of the most important things in this program is it's reunited me with people, and most especially with women. I can remember when I first came into the program, I still thought of myself as a girl. I really had a hard time with the concept of being a woman. And I don't know if anybody else can understand that, but it was real difficult for me. I felt like a little girl all the time. So one of the things that attracted me to Burns, too, because I felt real protected and safe with him and felt a lot like a little girl in that relationship. But reconnecting with the women and seeing the strength of the women in the program and the beauty in the faces of the women in the program, whether they were in Al-Anon or AA or OA or NA or ACOA or anything, just sitting and talking with the women and sharing our stories and sharing our pain and our trials and the particular things that women go through in our society and societies all around the world. Just as men, I'm sure, have certain almost, you know, rites of passage things that you all need to share with one another, and only another man would understand that. And that's what I got from the women in the program, was that sharing of their experience, strength, and hope as it pertained to me. About a year and a half ago, I finally realized that I was never really going to have a total program until I got a sponsor. At that point, I was sponsoring 8 people in this program, and I didn't have one. And somehow or other, it finally dawned on me that there was something really wrong with that picture, you know, that I was about to give away about as much as I had, and I was not getting it from anywhere. And there was a friend in my life that had been a friend for quite a while, and I respected her program highly, and we had been friends ever since she'd been in the program. And I had thought about asking her to sponsor me, and I used to make up all kinds of excuses, like it'd screw up the friendship, or she's too busy, she just got remarried, or she lives too far away, she's on the other side of town, or now she lives in another county. And finally I thought, well, you know, you really need a sponsor, and this is the one person that I really feel like I can, you know, that I would really like to have what she has. And I finally screwed up my courage and asked her, and what I realized was that once again my false pride and my ego had gotten in the way. I was afraid she'd turn me down. And then, of course, I'd have to hate her. I mean, that's what would end the friendship. It wouldn't be the relationship of sponsor-sponsoree that could grow and bloom and be a beautiful thing. She was going to tell me no, and I was going to have to hate her. And I really didn't want to do that. So I asked her anyway, and she laughed first. Secondly, she said, first of all, I want to tell you I'd be delighted. And secondly, she said, what took you so long? She had been waiting all this time for me to ask her. And I said, well, why didn't you ask me? And she said, no, it doesn't work that way. So Liz is my sponsor, and I'm deeply, deeply grateful for that, because she has, in this last year and a half, she has really walked me through almost a minefield of emotions and some things that have been going on personally in my life. I had a friend who was like a surrogate mother to me who had developed cancer, and a year ago, August 7th, she died of cancer. And that's another thing that I'm grateful for this program about, is that it gave me the strength and the sobriety and the courage and the ability to walk through those feelings sober, and the ability to stay with her and walk through those feelings and not have to run. I heard somebody saying last night at the meeting, they were talking about they wanted to send a letter to somebody who had cancer and they'd not gone by to visit them. And I really understood that need to not go by and visit, because it's painful to go sit with somebody and watch them die. It's not an easy thing to do. And because of the program and my sobriety, I was able to do that with Mavis and to the end. And I was able to say goodbye to her with dignity and allow her the dignity of saying goodbye, and not having to think, gosh, you know, I wish I'd been there for her. Too bad, you know. I was able to stay, and I will never be the same because of that. And it's because of this program that I was able to do that, because of the being able to sit with people and feel the depth of the feelings that they've gone through. Watching someone die, you know, we watch one another die in this program on a daily basis. It just didn't seem to be that different. Except I knew I didn't have to cut and run like I'd always done when it got painful. I was able to stay. And she's very proud of me right now. She was terribly dramatic and was a dancer, and so she's smiling at me right now and going, oh, I knew. Yeah. She was one of my great cheerleaders, and she gave me a lot, and I loved her deeply. And I can talk about her and not feel that sadness, because I did get to stay and I did get to finish that piece of her life and mine with her. When I asked Liz to sponsor me, I said, I want to do another fourth and fifth step. I don't really feel like I've done it. What would you suggest? And she said, why don't you look at the book? Duh. Okay. And so I did a fourth and fifth step with her.
And then I said, okay, I don't want to drop the ball here, but I tell you what, 6 and 7, I really don't know what to do here. She said, well, 6, you go home and you go over everything that we've just talked about and you ask yourself, do you have any little bird stories that you didn't tell? You know, the little bird stories, those stories that where you did something that you really feel bad about, but you decided not to tell that in your fifth step because they wouldn't understand it. So I did that. I went home and I did my sixth step and I called her the next day and I had a little bird story, but it was only, I just forgot it. I mean, it wasn't that big of a deal. And she laughed at that too. She said, That's not that big of a deal. And I said, well, I wanted to be complete as possible. And then I said, well, what about 7? And she said, I will tell you what my sponsor has shared with me, and I find this to be very effective on my 7th. She said, you make a list of your character defects, or you have made a list of your character defects, and I want you to sit down at the table, and I want you to think about each character defect and how it has been a direct problem in your life in the last 2 weeks. Think of incidences where fear, dishonesty, resentment, whatever your character defects are, procrastination, where are you? Write that down. And you know, that was really very helpful for me. I went home and I did that, or I was on the phone. I got off the phone and I did that. And I looked at how, and I wrote down several times, and I saw how these character defects woven in my life on a daily basis. There they were. Sometimes they were hiding underneath leaves and stuff, but they were really there in different incidences where I'd had problems. And so I did that, and then I called her back and said, okay, I've done that, now what? And you know, she said, well, you've got your list for 8, and you might want to think about starting on 9, and I did. And what I did was I wrote a letter to my grandparents, who were both dead, and I made amends to them. And then I have tried in the last year to make amends to my parents and my attitude. They know that I'm in the program. They don't understand it. They didn't see a lot of my drinking because I lived away from home during most of my drinking. But I have really, really tried to have a lot of patience and tolerance with my parents and changed my attitude around them as a form of amends to them. And then it stopped again. You know, I didn't do any more on the 9th step, and time passed, and I had an opportunity to get into a step study group, one of those 18-week big step studies, and with a bunch of women, and I did that. And so here I come around to another 4th step. Now, I hadn't done but one 4th step in the first 8 years that I was in the program, and last year and a half now, I've done 2 4 steps. What was really interesting about this particular 4th and 5th step that we did in this group is I'd only done the resentment columns. And in this, they ask you to do fears and sex conduct. And I had never looked at those, ever. And it was really, really interesting. That fear inventory was just phenomenal for me to see how much of my life was based on fear, how fearful I had been and how fearful in many ways I still was, and things I was afraid of, you know. Some of them we'd start laughing, we were sharing with one, you know, like spiders and dying and, you know, your pants falling down at a football game or something like that, you know. But there were a lot of really deep fears that came up in that sharing group. And then we went on to the sex conduct. And the way we did that was, because we all kind of hemmed and hawed around about it, and it was suggested that we do any conduct in any relationship we had been in. And that's when I did that particular inventory, that's when I really got my list. That's when I got step 8. I already knew my character defects, but I realized the number of people that I had harmed while drinking. And I never thought that I harmed anybody while I was drinking because I was always alone. I mean, I was a bar drinker, but I went home alone. And so that's been really very helpful for me, and I have begun working on step 9 anew and at a level that I don't think I would have understood a year ago. I know I wouldn't have understood a year ago. And it's going to be difficult. Some of the people, you know, I can't find. I don't know where they are. I don't even remember their names half the time. But it really has been telling about who I am, and it's begun to open a new freedom for me, and I really have started to begun to feel the relief that this program promises. I try to do a daily inventory in some form or another, but I don't really do a formal one. The one I really want to talk about is, because it's a current struggle that I'm going through, is step 11, and that is that conscious contact with God as I understand Him. And I'm really, I said this last night, I'm really having a hard time, not with the concept of God or the belief in God. I know that there's a God there, but I really want Him to have a face and skin and be breathing and warm and all that. And I don't know how to really resolve that other than when I come into rooms like this and I see all of you. And that's God. You know, for better or for worse. Everybody look around, that's it. You know, I mean, for me, that's... if I need that, this is where I can get that physical connection with the God of my understanding by coming here and sharing with you all and knowing that you love me, even though I may be just boring you to death. You'll sit and listen to me, and that's unconditional love, and that's God. That just came to me. So that's an accomplishment. Part of my struggle, too, is that I still don't want to turn over my will. I touched on that. I really am afraid that one of these days He's going to ask me to do something I really don't want to do, like go to Bolivia or where was it? Africa. Yeah, Jeanette doesn't want to go to Africa. But anyway, I try to keep my prayer and meditation real simple, like God help me or here I am, what do you think? You know, I mean, I've gotten real flip, and I think I've gotten almost like an adolescent in my prayers lately, just kind of, can I really piss you off bad enough to, excuse me, where are you, Marge? I'm sorry. To not be there. But anyway, I do at least try to make a stab at praying on a daily basis and some form of meditation. The greatest gift, I think there's so many gifts that the program has brought, but my favorite thing to do, this is my least favorite thing to do, and my most favorite thing to do is sponsorship. And I like to talk about sponsorship because it has been such a great gift to me, first of all, to have someone trust me enough to ask me to sponsor them and to entrust me with some of their pain, or all of their pain, and their lives and what's going on with their lives is very sacred. That's a very, very special gift for someone to give to another person. At least it is for me. And I still do sponsor about 8 people. And the gifts, you know, it sounds like a lot, but it keeps me so focused on my program. I mean, there are different gals, and each one brings a different gift with her. I have a sponsoree right now, and she's just finishing up seminary. She's in New York City. She's going to be an Episcopal priest. She went to Israel this summer and spent the summer there working on an archaeological dig. She couldn't get to meetings. She read her big book, and she wrote letters. I've seen her through college. I've seen her through accounting. She hated it. And now I've seen her through seminary. She's grown into a very fine, beautiful woman, and it is a gift. I mean, without this program, I would not have had that gift, and she's just very special to me. I'm very proud of her. I have another friend who's just moved to Colorado. She's got an unshakable faith in God that has buoyed me up when mine was really trembling. Patty is... a very special friend of mine. Her connection to God, as I said, is just unshakable. I've never seen anybody face as many things as she's had to face in her lifetime and come out just never angry at God, just going for it. A really spiritual, special lady. All of the people that I sponsor, one way or another, have brought so many gifts. I've got a new person who's, she's 8 years sober, and she had to, for reason, several reasons, she had to leave her current sponsor and asked me if I would sponsor her this past spring. She said, I really won't call that much because, you know, my life's pretty smooth. Well, she calls me about every week now. And Deb works such an incredible program. She nails the steps. It's almost like watching, you know, in the Olympics when they're doing the gymnastics and they nail it on the beam or something, and they just hit it. I mean, that's the way she hits these steps. She calls me and she says, this is the resentment, and we talk about it, and she says, okay, and I said, what's your part in it? And she says, this, this, and this. And I said, what are you going to do about it? This, this, and this, and boom, she's out the door. That's it. It's just great, but she'll call me and talk it all out. She's just really works an incredible program, and it's been a gift to me. I have learned so much from her, from watching her work her steps. And then I have some people that I sponsor that are a daily challenge, and only because I want so badly to fix them, and it pulls up all of my need to make everything nice and be the peacemaker or make it look good or make them feel better or people please or whatever. And so they really stretch me too. But the program hopefully leads me back to the steps, and that's what I then lead them back to. In 91, I told you, I graduated from the University of Louisville with a degree in counseling, and it's a very difficult line for me to walk between being a sponsor and being a counselor. And when I sponsor people, I warn them about that, and I say, you're going to have to call me on it, and I'm going to try to watch it. But it gets very shaky in there at times. I want to counsel them instead of sponsor them, and I will get up to my butt in it. Before I know it, I'm counseling them. You know, I'm saying, you know, write out the check. Did it? it really pulls me back to, you know, what's the program? What's the spiritual solution? What steps do they need to apply in this situation? You are not their therapist, you are their sponsor. And so it keeps me, hopefully I stay sharp in that area, or at least alert. I'm grateful to my higher power for leading me to this program of recovery and to sobriety, for the support of all those friends that I've mentioned and friends in my support group and the people that I sponsor are my friends and my support group also. For the people that I've met that I have to come all the way to Tennessee to see again, you know, it feels so comfortable and safe here right now because there's so many people that I've met before and I feel real comfortable and loved. And thanks, everybody, for coming up and telling me it was going to be okay before I talked. And I'm real grateful for my husband, Burns. And one of the things that I've just recently realized, and we've struggled over the last couple of years or 5 years, or I don't know, it depends on how, you know. And it's two alcoholics living in the same house, you know, and on any given day, both of us can be crazy. Most times it's him, but he gets to get up tomorrow night, so I just set myself up big time. But one of the things, I was talking to somebody the other day, and I think it was Liz, my sponsor, and I said, you know, one of the things that I've realized is that if it weren't for the tensions that we've had in our lives with one another, I would never have been stretched to grow to where I am right now. I would have sat back on my laurels and been happy, or thought I was happy, without really developing the insights that I've had to develop through the struggle that you have when you're in a relationship with another human being, especially if you're both alcoholic and recovering. It gets weird. You know, it gets real strange. So I'm really grateful for that relationship. I've always had a real deep faith in it, and it just wouldn't have been as, I would not have grown as much without it. I really do know that. And for his love and support. Always the love. And always the wretched honesty that he shows with me. But most of all, I'm really grateful because I'm done. That brings you up to date. Oh, no, I'm not done. There is one thing I do want to mention. I am done, actually. But I have had the great privilege. In August, I began working with, as a counselor, with a children's group of 7, 8, and 9-year-old children with DSU, and that's Daughters and Sons United. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that or not, but it's a branch of Parents United. These children were sexually abused in the home. And that has been a real gift for me, because what it has done is it's taken me back, not to my own childhood, because I was not molested in the home, but just working with the kids. I have no children of my own. I have 2 stepchildren, but no children of my own. And just working with these kids and seeing how spontaneous, with everything that they've gone through, the resiliency and their survivorship of these kids, and the love and the bright eyes and the excitement that they show, has been such a gift for me. And only in sobriety would I have been able to get through school, and only in sobriety would I be entrusted with their little lives an hour and a half of the week. And I'm really grateful to God for that. I'm grateful for the children. They are great teachers. And with that, I am definitely officially done. Thank you so much for listening.